Welcome back. You can follow me on Twitter at J Church Radio. You can follow Barrett at Barrett Brown. Tonight, we're discussing it all: anonymous, prison, journalism, internet privacy, censorship, and his current endeavor, the Pursuance Project. That's right. I'm your host, Jimmy Church. This is Coast to Coast AM. Stay with us. Welcome back to Coast AM. Special Sunday night. We have Barrett Brown here. Now, Barrett, we started to talk a little bit about prison right before the break, and I don't want to spend a whole lot of time on it, but the thing is, it's an experience that most don't get a chance to go and check out and learn from. If you did learn something from it, and there was a benefit besides possibly being reformed, what was it?
Well, I learned the due process is not something you get just by saying over and over again as a country that we have due process. It's something, and you can learn this in the judicial system as well, but it's something that, you know, is easy to take for granted and is easier to lose. I mean, due process is like what you call a potential energy, putting a rock on a cliff. It's not something that comes naturally. It is the result of a great deal of civic virtue, of serious attention to one's civic duties as a society, and to the extent those things deteriorate, just based on the culture, based on just history, it's easy to forget that this is something that is not only important, but is hard to maintain. And that's something that, you know, we see over and over again. Not just my case, of course, was very just highly bizarre in the extent of you know, how it's approached, and my prison term was highly bizarre and how much I was retaliated against. But we see it over and over again, with particularly with other activists. One person I wanted to mention tonight, just briefly, is Marty Gottesfeld, who is in pretrial detention right now. He engaged in a hack for the purpose of bringing to attention the plight of this young girl who was being held in a hospital, very much against her parents' will. And based on his efforts, you know, she was removed from that hospital, taken to another one where she was properly diagnosed. And in his case, he has been retaliated against as a prisoner who, like me, and like John Kiriakou, the CIA torture whistleblower, has been writing from prison and has paid the price for it. And that's something, you know, I always make sure to note that, you know, my case is an interesting story. You know, some of the things that come up, you know, has certain relevance to certain specific issues. But broadly here, we're seeing the same thing over and over again. We're seeing that there is, we have deteriorated as a society. And it's not, I'm not saying that things used to be a lot better necessarily. In many ways, things are better in this country than they were, you know, at any point. But there is also a deepening of the deterioration, a deepening of the failures, and at the same time, a lack of seriousness on the part of the press, for instance, in terms of pursuing these things, bringing them to public attention. And there's a lack of seriousness on the part of the public, I think, relative to what we saw in the 60s and 70s, in terms of going out and fixing things. And that's the key lesson. I mean, I learned such a great deal in prison, but that's the key lesson that kept hammering itself into me over that 4 years.
And the retaliation on so many young adults, right? We're not talking about career criminals or things like that. We are just talking about, I almost can go as far as to say kids. And the retaliation on these young adults has been extreme in some cases. And I think a lot of it is out of anger and frustration on the part of the agencies that are trying to solve this problem, a problem that they think is occurring. But is there a point of going too far with hacktivism? Is there a line in the sand that shouldn't be crossed?
Well, there were certainly things that others did that I was close to that I criticized publicly and privately. There were things, in some cases, that I did that, you know, of course, it wasn't involving hacking because I was not a hacker, but things here and there that I wish I had not done. But for the most, and that's something that's the age-old question of, you know, when you have to or when you simply do go beyond the confines of the existing structure of government and law, you do come against these questions. The questions are, you know, even though this is a criminal institution in some respect that you're up against, what is your obligation? How much, you know, it's easy for people, and this happens over and over again in activism, it happens in revolution, it happens, you know, it's a pattern in which you forget that you too are subject to an ethical restraints, and that you too and your allies must be held to a high standard. And it's very easy to lose sight of that. And losing sight of that isn't just a matter of morality. It's not just a matter of, well, now you've done this horrible thing. It's also something that does take away from your pragmatic ability to affect change. If you don't have that moral authority that's visible and something you can articulate, if you give in to that desire to say, well, because they're worse, we can go up to this point, up to the point where they're at, and as long as you don't cross it, we're at least still better. That's not something that's going to be, that's not a viable long-term strategy. It will not attract and maintain the sort of people with the moral vigor that you need in an effective movement. And so these are questions we've discussed a lot, and there's different opinions on our side of things. There are still disagreements about things that were done back then between me and certain other individuals who were involved. There's obviously been a huge fracture regarding WikiLeaks in the last year or so in particular. And, you know, it's important that we have these debates. You must always be ready to attack your friends in defense of your enemies if you're going to be an honest person when necessary.
What do you think is going to happen with Julian Assange over the next week?
You know, I was up in New York last week to go speak at HOPE, the Hackers of Planet Earth conference, which
right.
They have every 2 years since late 80s, I believe, founded by a guy named, they called himself Emmanuel Goldstein, who was one of the early kind of sort of philosopher hackers. And while there, I was also went on the Chris Hedges show, which is on RT, the taped show, and he did two introductions. One was the introduction that would be played if Julian Assange was still in the embassy. The other would be the introduction that we played if he had already been arrested.
Right.
Because apparently that morning, there had already been rumblings that this was going to happen, and then that was confirmed publicly, I think, the next day. This is the point that we've known, I guess, that was going to come. I mean, this was not a sustainable status quo with him being in the Ecuadorian embassy in London. It was going to have to end somehow. It's still somewhat shocking to know that it's going to end and that he will be in British custody. I've had a break, you know, with Assange and some of the people close to him over certain things. But I still, you know, will always defend his rights against governments. The governments that are going after him and that have been since 2009, 2010, they're not going after him for the things he did wrong. They're going after him for exposing their misconduct to begin with.
Right.
And so it's a difficult, you know, it's one of those things. It's an upsetting thing for a lot of us, and it's caused, you know, there's been a lot of bad blood around this. But again, it is more important that we maintain standards and avoid falling into the trap of tribalism, factionalism. It's important that we be right. That we always try to be right, and that involves, in many cases, being critical of people that we don't want to be critical of people that we just did 4 years in prison,
right?
Because of, but it's a necessary thing.
Now, with Julian, and let's say he walks out of the embassy and he gets arrested by the British, or quite possibly us and an extradition to the United States. But if that happens, does that trigger like a doomsday mechanism where there's going to be a massive document and data dump on WikiLeaks that is material that's been held back?
This is one of those things where there's no telling what he has prepared.
Right.
There's always been talk for years and years of him having what we call a dead man switch.
Right.
And he wouldn't even have it. I mean, he could clearly have somebody else, like Sarah Harrison, who's kind of his second in command, release that thing for him. He doesn't even need a dead man switch in the official respect. But yes, it's going to change a lot of things. and there will be, you know, there was a document that was written years ago by a company called Endgame Systems. This is one of the things we found in the H.P. Gary emails when those were hacked in early 2011. They had been working, you know, on this Team Themis thing that we ended up disrupting, as well as on another project, apparently for Booz Allen Hamilton, that involved going after WikiLeaks and Anonymous both in some unspecified way that we don't know about. But they wrote a document analyzing Anonymous and analyzing WikiLeaks and their relationship at that time. And Anonymous back then was often sort of coming to the assistance of WikiLeaks in various respects. And they speculated in that document what would happen with Anonymous if Assange were to be arrested or assassinated. And they didn't answer the question specifically, but they referred to Anonymous that it would, I think the word they used was activate, that it would enter a more militant state. Now, that's no longer operative because Anonymous barely exists in any real form compared to how it did in 2011, and because there has been a realignment since then regarding WikiLeaks and its constituency. But I think things are going to get pretty, I think, very complicated very soon. And you know, obviously the Russia-U.S. thing plays into that. And and anyone making hard and fast predictions about this, I think, is going to have a hard time doing so. I think it's premature. There is no telling what will happen.
And then we have this, we've got like four different pretty serious situations that are playing out right now with the world in general and the internet. Of course, we have Facebook, and then that combines into data mining. We have privacy, we have censorship, and we have fake news. All of these were not issues just 15 years ago, right? 20 years ago, these weren't even words we used. Well, maybe censorship a little bit. But today, this is the world that we live in, Barrett. I mean, how secure are we? Not only us privately as citizens, but what about the electrical grid, different countries around the world, and what have you? You know, how secure are things? Or are they just not? Is it wide open?
You know, one of the things that a government does, whether we call it good or bad or moral or immoral, is to try to keep a handle on things, you know, including the U.S. And that was something that they could do. They could have the Brookings Institution or their own internal analysts, you know, write up scenarios for, say, nuclear warfare or, you know, the expansion of the Soviet Union's sphere of influence. We've gotten to the point since then in which it is out of their purview. It is not a horizon they can see. It takes a very, very agile mind to even anticipate some of these things. And, you know, the internet is the cause of that. You know, the human collaboration, what is the limiting factor on what happens, on how complex things get, on the direction things go. And when human collaboration was very geographically limited and history had a slower tempo, obviously that's something where you can get your head around it. You can
say, well,
probably 20 years from now, Prussia will still be Prussia. And right. There'll be a war, but Prussia might have another piece of territory, but things will basically be the same. That is so, the current situation is so contrary to that. That's the key problem now, not just from the standpoint of, you know, individuals who are very in favor of open societies, in favor of liberty, but from the standpoint of governments, from the standpoint of governments that are, you know, perhaps unwieldy and in some cases evil. They too are going to struggle to do even the basic things that, you know, we all kind of agree need to be done, because the proliferation of technology, the hyperactive tempo of history that's been made possible by the internet, by the sudden, relatively historically sudden potential for mass collaboration among individuals across the planet, that just changes everything in a way that I don't think they've grasped. I don't think you really can get your hands around it. All you can do is kind of determine that this is the case, that things are going to be chaotic, and try to have structures in place, institutions in place to react to those things. That's the best you can do. But it's anyone who's not worried is a fool.
Yeah, I have spoken to some pretty serious, not to go into any details, some pretty serious hackers, the real deal. And where I said, okay, you know, how easy is it for you to do whatever? And I heard the same thing over and over. You know, give me a place to go and give me 5 minutes and I can get it done. And I said, really? What stops you from, well, you know, it's a sense of morals and moral character. But that's not what should scare you. What should scare you is the bored hacker in Russia that gets angry because he can do the same things that we just don't do. And it was just a scary thought. Just 5 minutes, and we are talking about real issues for this planet.
Yeah, it's the same. It's the same problem that we faced with nuclear proliferation. You know, at first, 1946. There's one nation that has the bomb, and it doesn't feel the need to use it. A couple of years later, you know, the generals who spoke to Congress about nuclear proliferation in the late 40s, they estimated it would take, you know, Russia 10 years to have one, and it was like 2 years. And then suddenly you have other nations getting it. Now, you know, as this technology proliferates, as it gets more accessible, the chances of a disaster increase. Now, we, for a number of reasons, have gotten through that so far, and in some cases kind of forgotten about it because other things have come and sort of eclipsed that old standby concern of nuclear proliferation. But we have a similar deal with anything involving information technology, anything involving hacking, anything involving propaganda. You know, these were the things my greatest concern with the kind of technologies that we exposed and researched was not just that governments would have them, but that everyone would. And that it would become harder and harder as the means to confuse and to lie and to manufacture events and to proliferate, you know, fake people online, which is one of the technologies that I was most focused on. It's going to be harder and harder to really assess what is happening and what is true and what is false. And it's hard enough already.
When we come back after the break, I do want to spend some time on that. The idea with when it comes to AI or even sock puppets, and you do not know who you are necessarily arguing with, but it is the way to change emotional states of millions of people at the same time and continue to fracture and divide this planet. And we, you know, Barrett, we see it happening right now, and nobody seems to want to do anything about it. And that's the other scary part for me. This is Coast to Coast AM, a very special event tonight. Our guest is Barrett Brown. I'm your host, Jimmy Church. More with Barrett right after this short break. Stay with us. I'm your host, Jimmy Church. This is Coast to Coast AM. All right, our guest tonight is Barrett Brown. We're discussing everything, and I'm talking about anonymous prison journalism, internet privacy, censorship, fake news, what is going on today, internet security, yourself, everything. He's going to be here for the full show, and we're going to be taking your calls. I guess we can do that at the top of the hour. Nathan, you want to do that at the top of the hour? Donna, you good with that? Donna says, top of the hour. Let's do it. It's Coast to Coast AM. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Coast AM. I have had the best weekend hanging out with all of you. I'm your host, Jimmy Church. Now, Barrett, when you got out of prison and you got arrested again is one of the craziest stories out of everything that you've been through. And you've been through some pretty intimidating stuff. But before we get to that, because I want to spend some time on that, I got this question from Eddie on Twitter. And when I was at the Hope Conference 2 years ago, and I'm walking around interviewing people and having a really good time, when everybody found out that I was doing what I was doing and who I was, they would ask me if I knew Gary McKinnon. And I was like, wait a minute, of course I do. You mean you know Gary? He was held up on a pedestal. They were so proud of Gary McKinnon over there about what he did for us in our community. It's the UFO aspect and and NASA computers and what he did in that hack. Very simple hack, but he pulled it off. But for hackers, it's about getting into the system. And Gary pulled that off and had two countries fighting over him. You know, what do you think about Gary McKinnon?
Well, the most relevant thing to me in this, simply because a friend of mine, Larry Love, who's also a British citizen, was also, they were also seeking to extradite him for a while, and this just got resolved recently. And McKinnon's case, preceding Larry Love's, was a great victory for the rights of British citizens not to be subjected to the American justice system, which, as I've explained, I went on the BBC a few months ago regarding Lori Love's case, it is not the civilized, rational system that the average Western European would expect. And so, Mr. McKinnon, I don't know a great deal about a lot of the history of these hackers. I do know him, and he's kind of the archetype of the investigative hacker who he wants the information. He knows there's something there. He wants people to have it. And he's going to take risks to get it. Aaron Schwartz, you know, did the same thing in a more sort of mundane way, Aaron Schwartz was one of the co-founders of Reddit in a way, invented RSS. It was sort of an internet visionary who was prosecuted for releasing scientific papers from his MIT student accounts to the public. Papers representing research that the public had paid for, but which they had to also pay to read. And he was prosecuted by the DOJ and was facing 20 years. And rather than plea to 2 years, he committed suicide.
Hung himself.
Yes. It was about 6 months after I got arrested. And, you know, it's a great thing that Gary McKinnon and Larry Love and others who the U.S. has sought to make an example of, have managed to stay out of their clutches because, you know, it's a vastly unjust thing, the emphasis that the DOJ have. The kind of people they're always going out of their way to capture versus the kind of people that get away with whatever they want in this country. It's, you know, it's very indicative.
Yeah, and when it comes to Gary McKinnon, it's about this. He wanted information on UFOs. Everybody said that he didn't succeed, it didn't matter, but yet you had Obama, you had two heads of state battling over this guy when allegedly it was nothing. Wait a minute here. What's the big deal? Right? Either he found this information or he didn't. Why are two heads of state fighting for it was a fascinating thing to watch this play out.
Right. When you go hunting for information involving UFOs or anything involving aerospace in U.S. databases, no one can argue against the fact that you are going to find interesting things that are top secret. You know, we've got people who are UFO skeptics, you know, across the board. You are coming into contact with very well-kept secrets within the U.S. System, and they will hunt you down.
Well, I have said, like that, you know? Yeah, they don't. And I have said many times, Barrett, that disclosure when it comes to the UFO subject, we'll come back to this later in the show, but when it comes to the UFO subject, I would think that it's not going to happen with the president stepping up to a podium and admitting to UFOs are real on live television. It would come from a data dump. It would come from anonymous or somebody getting into files and exposing that and getting it out into the public. What's stopping anonymous or anybody else from just doing just that?
Well, the thing about anonymous and a lot of these, you know, what we would call, you know, non-state actors is that, like, in many cases, they don't always know. They're not always in a position to know what the target is they need to hit. Now, there were always some ex-military guys that we were involved with. We have, you know, there was always ex-intelligence people that we could talk to, or people who had worked at Booz Allen Hamilton, for instance, that we approached to ask about certain high-level things. But even then, I don't think generally the information regarding like high-end national security involving aerospace is going to be easily obtainable, even if you're a great hacker. You know, the U.S. has had really bad, surprisingly bad cybersecurity in the last, you know, forever. And that's why the Chinese Aurora attacks years ago were so successful in stealing trade secrets from companies and the U.S. government, and why the Russians have successfully done the same thing over and over again. They're now addressing that finally, partly because of Anonymous that had sort of rung their bell and kind of, you know, gave them a reality check. But it's just, it's a matter of knowing in some capacity exactly what to hit. And to an extent beyond that, I think there's a lot of things that you, and again, I'm speaking as a layman, essentially, even though I did work with a lot of hackers, but I think a lot of the most important things that one would want to know are what they call air-gapped, or at any rate, not available to hackers, not available via the internet, is my supposition.
The story that I talked about at the beginning of the show, you finally get out of prison. And I immediately, Greg Hausch and I were talking leading up to your release date, right? And you're out. I'm like, Greg, okay, you know, let's go. You know, I'm ready. And it was difficult. But 3 months later in April, 4 months later, you got arrested. You got, take me to that day. What happened? Did they throw a bag over your head and, you know, dump you into a car and take you to an undisclosed location? What happened?
I wish that things were such that that was the kind of things they felt they needed to do. Unfortunately, the way things are in this country right now, they can do these things very openly.
Right.
Knowing that that no one's going to lift a finger against them. What happened was it had become the halfway house administrators. I was at a halfway house for a couple months after getting out of prison, and then was on home confinement at my mom's place for a few months after that. By statute, and I was required to check in every week at the halfway house, and I mentioned to my counselor there that I was going on PBS and also on Vice. I just came up with a conversation. I was just chatting with her, and she decided this was something that I had to get permission for from the BOP, the Bureau of Prisons, which I know is false because I gave interviews from the radio or over the phone from prison. I'm very familiar with the operations manual for Bureau of Prisons on inmate press access. It's very, very clear. It's, you know, because of the Supreme Court, it is somewhat liberal towards us. We are allowed to talk to the press. The only time the BOP has to be involved is when a reporter is actually trying to come to a prison to speak to an inmate. But that was not the case here. So they got the BOP involved, and there were some phone conversations in the next couple days that I recorded. In fact, I went on a radio show down here out of Houston, and we called live on the radio this BOP official to ask her why she was violating my rights. And, you know, she didn't really respond. I did the broadcast on Vice, at least. And then the day before I was going to go on PBS, the PBS crew that had come down to Dallas to interview me, I was called into the halfway house that early that morning. Told a report, got there. I kind of realized what was up. Called my city councilman, Philip Kingston, who's a great civil liberties supporter. Tried to prepare. And then two U.S. Marshals came and arrested me and took me to the same federal holding facility, Siegelville, that I'd been at prior. And I was there for 5 days. There were no charges. There was not even a write-up, like a disciplinary write-up, for BOP inmates and, you know, home confinement, you know, where releases, there was nothing.
What did they say?
It was the most illegal, most demonstrably illegal thing that actually ever happened to me in the course of all of this.
Yes, and this is the United States of America, you know, and this actually went down. What were you completely isolated, or what were they telling you over those 5 days?
Well, nothing. Well, the people at the jail, they knew who I was. I'd been there for a year previously, and so. There are actually some people there, some administrators who are kind of fond of me. They have either a grudging respect for me based on things that I did back then, that sometimes complicated their lives, including a demonstration that we had that they had to crack down on. And you know, others just don't know anything. I mean, there's no one at the BOP that were like talking to them, because there should not be a paper trail from their standpoint. You know, they're doing something that everyone knows is illegal. You know, in not writing up a charge or whatever. And so my conversations were solely with journalists, ironically, from the phone there, and a law firm that was hired to get me out by the D Magazine publisher down here, Wick Allison, who used to run National Review, or maybe still does. He paid $11,000 to a New York law firm, Haynes and Boone, to threaten the BOP, essentially, to say, we're going to take this in front of a judge and ask you to present your cause for arresting this person. And then they immediately released me.
And warned again not to speak to the media.
Yeah, when I got to the halfway house, I wrote a long article about this D Magazine afterwards, and I included links to the original phone conversations I recorded. This halfway house director, Merrill Wells, down here in Dallas, told me, you know, we still need you to sign these documents. They wanted me to sign these documents and to get the press to sign the documents, which was my big problem. They were basically trying to get me to help them impose an unconstitutional prior restraint on major press outlets, including PBS, which is a publicly, you know.
Yeah.
You know, and I was just not going to do that. And so then they give me different documents this time and basically, you know, threaten me again. And so I basically signed one of them and took the other one with me. And the one I signed was not the same document. It was a lesser document I had no problem signing. It was a sort of a face-saving gesture on their part that I had no – I don't care if they say face or not. And I was actually happy to sign something, because that would be, if it came down to it, evidence
right.
that I'd been coerced into signing something. So I did agree to that. And you know, that was it after that.
Well, and now they expect you to work once you're discharged from prison, and you should be allowed to provide for yourself. And you're a journalist, and you deal with the media. And it seems to me like they are telling you that you're not allowed to work, and they're trying to continue. You've already paid your debt, right? But they're continuing the penalty.
Well, there are several different layers of debt, unfortunately. And one of them, first of all, when you're released from prison, you do have to have a 40-hour week job. And I early on said, well, I have been a columnist, you know, while in prison. I was always a writer. I was making money in prison as a writer. I was making actually more money than I ever had as a free person writing columns from prison. I won the National Magazine Award. I'm still writing this column. I also have a book deal now. I had a book deal in place with Macmillan about a month after getting out. We had, you know, negotiations over the phone, obviously, from my halfway house. And so I said, these are my jobs. They bring in quite a bit of money. And can I just have these jobs? And it's like, no, you can't. You have to have a 40-hour week job as well. So I got a job at D Magazine down here in Dallas, which I had written for once or twice before, and which had written about me quite a bit, covering city council. Now, the problem with that is they said that I was not allowed to touch a computer during this period. And that was not based on any actual documentation. There was an order in the judgment when I was sentenced that went on probation, which I was not under yet. When I was under federal probation, I could have a laptop, but they'd have to install monitoring software on it, which is fine. And they're going to monitor me anyway. They might as well have some low-end software to boot. So, you know, with that and other things, including the later subpoena of The Intercept, and if my literary agency and my publisher, which they did last year,
well, how
they have interfered over and over again with the process of me being able to provide for myself. Yes.
Yeah, and what about, you know, writing your book? I mean, that certainly is directly affected. And you had a pretty hefty fine that was tied into your conviction, too. It was almost $1 million.
A restitution of about $890,000, most of which to go to Stratford. And to that end, you know, they had now had a toolkit with this restitution by which to harass me further. And they did, and they sent those subpoenas to my agency, my publisher, and all that, and then forced them, sent them a court order not to pay me any money any of my income, any of my advances, book advances, which is what I was going to live on, until further notice. And that further notice came a year afterwards, a few weeks ago. So I finally got my, they were able to pay me my book advance.
Yeah, I won't read your tweet that you posted that day, but needless to say, you were pretty happy.
Oh yeah, it was nice to have money. I mean, in the meantime, I had to rely on my mom's savings. I had to sign an apartment lease, and then suddenly, you know, I got my first payment from the publisher, and then it was cut off. And then the thing was, I couldn't even go and work at a labor deal that I used to do back when I was 19. You know, show up in the morning and get whatever, because they could subpoena that. Under this restitution order, they could send anyone I worked for, anyone I wrote for money, including The Intercept, including outlets that are doing very sensitive work the government doesn't like, could have been subject and were to these various court orders, having them that takes them a lot of time and expense and resources to respond to, and which also entails the forced provision of communications between myself and my editors. So it was a very difficult situation that is still in play to some extent, but, you know, at least now I have money.
Well, that's the good news. And you know what else? We're going to be taking phone calls next, Barrett, so get ready for that. I'm your host, Jimmy Church. It's Barrett Brown on a Sunday night, and this is Coast to Coast AM.